Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Folks, my wonderful, wonderful audience, I'm back again. I'm here for another hour, our weekly session. We go on PRN.FM, for those of you who don't know. And then the next day, usually, we end up on YouTube. And we try to be as interesting, as pertinent, as critically aware as we can be. And I want to thank PRN.FM for putting me out on the internet radio world. So glad to see all of you, and glad to see Robert Yoho. This is going to be an interesting hour. Robert's last name is spelled Y-O-H-O, and it's actually European. That's interesting. What's the origin of the name?
It's German. It's actually Western European. So, yeah.
And did they spell it that way in Europe, or is that an American derivative, Yoho, Y-O-H-O?
There's several different spellings. You can find them in any major city. There's J-O-H-O-E's and Y-O-H-O-E's, and then there's the Hoadley-Hoes.
All right. Robert Yoho is a physician. He's been an emergency room doc for a while. I always just admire them. I think being an emergency room doc is just an amazing life. And you have to know a lot of stuff, and you got to be on your toes. You got to really know a lot about medicine in general. And then he went on to be a cosmetic surgeon. And he shows a certain pride in being really a physician and just having been a physician in a number of different areas now. He somehow or another, at some point, and maybe he'll tell us about that, he began to get to be pretty critical of what was going on in medicine. But it wasn't right at the start. And many of you know that when almost every time a guest comes on the show, whether I know them or not, it could be somebody just Ginger heard about in Europe or something, and it sounded really interesting to her, and you know, we talk about it. And then when the person comes on, they almost always surprise me and tell me how much my early books meant to them. Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and how it changed their lives. Well, my book apparently meant quite a bit to Robert Yoho, Talking Back to Prozac, because as he tells the story, he completely dismissed it. So that's kind of interesting. And dismissed it in favor of Peter Kramer's listening to Prozac, and mine, of course, is talking back to Prozac. Talking back to Prozac. Are you having some noise there, Bob?
Judy, can't make any noise. I'm on the stop. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. You have to cut this out, I guess.
No. We can leave it in.
Okay. So, all right. No worries.
Judy, you're going to have to come on camera.
Judy, come on camera
and say hello if you're going to make noise in the background.
Come on. This is my better half. I'm very proud of her. So this is Dr. Breggin.
Hi, Dr. Breggin.
Here's Judy.
Hi. I'm delighted to meet you. You look as happy to be on this video as my wife would be. I've never been able to get her to stand still that long.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Judy.
That was the appearance.
Yeah, that was the appearance.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so yeah, I was actually completely dismissed your book, and I was very impressed with Dr. Kramer's book, and I had prescribed, you know, I was an early adopter of Prozac, and I passed it out like jelly beans, and I probably prescribed, I mean, who knows, maybe $1 million worth of Prozac over a few decades before, and I didn't catch on to this until I was nearing retirement, and I started to read about corruption. And of course, the psychiatric corruption is, it's probably the most troubling part of medicine and the most expensive medical field in terms of wasted resources and terrible results, frankly. But, you know, I know your listeners are quite familiar with this, and so I've got a lot of other things to talk about.
Well, no, not everybody, Bob. I actually, can I call you Bob? Is that a name of your?
Yeah,
Peter. I've been so much talking about COVID-19 that they haven't heard a good whipping of psychiatry, of psychiatry in a long time. And some of them must be salivating at the thought. Because I've actually not been focusing much on that. And by the way, I actually was kind of deluded about psychiatry in the reverse way, in that I thought psychiatry must be far more evil than the rest of the pharmaceutical industry.
Maybe not.
And you know, apropos of what you're saying about it's being maybe the worst, I think the vaccine industry is by far the most bizarrely powerful and threatening. I don't know. You would know this much better than I think from your recent work. Who's got more billions of dollars, the vaccine industry or the psychiatric? Probably now the vaccine.
Psychiatry is $230 billion. The vaccine is a drop in the bucket compared to that. But no, the vaccine, I am not an expert on the weeds of vaccine, because I knew from the middle of last year what was going on, because I had been studying the pharmaceutical industry, and I knew that these guys, these are not my words. These are the words of Peter Gotcha and Peter Getch. How do you say it?
Yes, on this show we call him Peter Goetze.
And Peter Rost. They both worked for the pharmaceutical industry, and they call them mobsters. And we do know that they, as judged by their criminal settlements with American prosecutors, they are the most criminal industry in history. So I never gave the vaccine a second thought. I didn't think it was going to be efficacious. I knew that we didn't have a vaccine for 20 years that did a thing, and that includes the HPV vaccine, which Japan dropped like a hot potato because they saw that they put away over half the studies and didn't show them. And that also includes the influenza vaccine, which you can look up on Cochrane reviews and find out how ineffective that is. It doesn't freaking work. Doesn't prevent pneumonia or any of the things it's supposed to prevent. So I dismissed the COVID vaccine, and I'm not a particularly expert about that. So I've got a lot of other things to talk about. We don't have to even mention that again. I know you guys are the COVID people, but go ahead.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So, approach this whole situation. Well, first of all, what enlightened you at such an older age, sir?
Yeah, I was probably early 60s, and I had been interested in bioidentical hormones for a while, and I couldn't figure out why they were suppressed. And that's a whole other subject. We don't have to talk about that now, but I worked on writing a book about that, and then I got diverted into the general medical corruption field and started reading books about that, and including reviewing your works again, and things by Norton Hadler and Whitaker, Robert Whitaker. They were seminal in my reading selection. I just got more drawn into the story, and I was just stunned by the general corruption in all of medicine. And so my book, Butchered by Healthcare, is about not only the industry not only about the industry influences, but how the doctors are amateurs. They're amateur fraudsters compared to the industry people. The industry people are students of influencing people, or essentially lying to them and getting them to behave in certain ways. And their ethical limits are, you know, unknown, to put it in a very kind way, right? The doctors are trained, and in theory, they put patients first. And in fact, many of them are still very idealistic and trying very hard, despite all the barriers to their successful actions treating and helping patients. But my book is about both, and I can go over some of the themes, the major themes in my book, if you want me to do that. I can just lift this. Okay. So, in rough order of cost, right, insurance is the worst. They skim roughly 25% off the entire $4 trillion healthcare industry, and this doesn't happen in other countries. As far as I can tell, they serve no utility whatsoever, and they actually incentivize excess use. It's hard to believe, but that's they do. In other words, they you know, it's like a blank check they write, and they are unable to monitor the standards carefully. They're an inappropriate monitoring thing. Okay, so this, hospitals are the second worst. They are 40% roughly of the entire bill. They are nonprofits, and this gives them very little oversight. And I mean, it's they really care very little for the patients, and their billing practices are egregious. It's an amazing story when you get into it. The third is big pharma and medical devices. Now, medical devices, big pharma is $1.3 trillion gross worldwide. Medical devices are something like $300 trillion, but they're cut from the same cloth. They basically are aggressive sales and industrial medicine organizations that their top priorities are not patients. Number four, I thought the journals and the academics of medicine, the ruination of that and the purchase of them by big pharma and other industrialized medicine, I thought that was the fourth worst. Number five, mental health, which I don't want to go into anymore because your listeners have heard a lot about it. That's the most expensive single medical sector. Number six,
probably the least to offer. I mean, the rest of the sectors have something to offer.
Absolutely. Yeah. The heart industry, both coronary artery bypass grafting and angioplasty almost shouldn't be done. They don't have a utility according to the science. And coronary artery bypass grafting, the only thing that where it's affected mortality or lifespan is in the little 2 centimeter left main, when they plumb around that. All the rest of that stuff doesn't work at all. And that's been clearly demonstrated in multiple studies. And the totality of the benefit for coronary artery bypass grafting is a 20% improvement in mortality at 5 years for that little left main plumbing job. And that's it. The rest of it doesn't freaking work. Angioplasty, the only place where it's been demonstrated to work is in ST elevation myocardial infarctions. That's the most severe kind of heart attacks. And people go to the cath lab for all kinds of things, including unstable. They send them through the emergency room, claim they have unstable angina, send them up to the cath lab. They don't have ST elevation heart attacks. That's the only place. Now, the worst thing about angioplasty is it has a number needed to treat of 1 in 40. In other words, they supposedly save one person for every 40 people they treat. Now, that sounds reasonable, but it's much more dangerous than angioplasty on people who are not having a heart attack. They kill one person in 40. You get it? So it's a wash. I mean, it's awful. I mean, it's crazy.
Take a minute and look at that number that you're talking about, which people haven't heard much about. It's the number to treat, basically, before you get an effect. And talk about that, because, treating 40 people to get a good effect on one doesn't seem like the best odds in the world to me, but it's a common standard. Talk about that. Might be very interesting.
Okay, number needed to treat is a great little rule of thumb that doctors should have up their sleeve every time they look at a medical paper. Now, the guy I trust the most, Norton Adler, he thinks that if the number needed to treat is north of 20, the results would never be replicated in another trial. In other words, it's crazy. But
let's look at it. So if you have to treat more than 20 people to get
save one
effect,
life, yeah, to save one life,
save one life would really basically, if it's an antidepressant, is to just raise somebody's depression or whatever. So what you're saying is that that's such a long shot that it's probably not even going to be replicated in another study.
That's right. And now he's a very conservative statistician. 1 in 40 is generally accepted by most statisticians, but the thing is, 1 in 100 is commonly done, right? For example, back pain, even the surgery for back pain, they don't have 1 in 100 positive result. Statin drugs, antidepressants is completely nebulous. There's no standard for it. They use surveys and doctor opinions. Obviously, the problem with psychiatry is there's no objective testing. It's all soap bubbles. You know? So that there are other statistical hoaxes besides, you can look at the number needed to treat. They ignore that. They go to 1 in 100 or 1 in 40 or even higher. I mean, there are some of these things that they worry about, breast cancer with the hormones. They're 1 in 1,000 or lower, you know, and they claim that it's statistically significant. The heuristic that I use is if the numbers are small, the studies are almost always fraudulent. If they say it just reached statistical significance, it probably has no meaning and would never be replicated. If you don't understand what's going on, just like with financial advisors or lawyers, somebody is pulling the wool over your eyes to sell a drug or something, you know? So you should, certainly physicians should understand everything the drug rep says, everything that happens in the medical paper, anything that Bob Yoho or Peter Bregan ever tells them. We should understand it completely. If you feel like you don't understand, somebody is telling you a story to make some money.
Now, you threw out a very interesting stat, and I think it's good to talk about general medicine and just let people kind of get an idea of how confused, really how manipulated everything is out there. You mentioned that with the statins, you don't even get 1 in 100 successes. I don't know if you ever met Tom Moore, an old friend of mine. He wrote a book on the statins while I was still thinking psychiatry was really the only really corrupt place, and pointed out that unless you had a really toxic level of lipids, you know, maybe 400 or 500, you weren't going to be helped at all, and that it was a farce. And this is a huge industry. I mean, everybody my age in the country is supposed to be on statins from the way doctors talk. It's that bad, isn't it, still, what you're saying?
Well, there's two narrow cases where the statins supposedly have a very small effect, right? And one is post-heart attack, and that sounds reasonable to me, but it is a very small effect. And the other is in hereditary dyslipidemia, which is those very, very
high numbers, yeah.
That you talked about. But in these, you know, probably the lifestyle changes have a much, and these drugs are much not bad. Non-toxic. They are not non-toxic. They kill an occasional person. They create a lot of problems, mental problems, all kinds of things. So I think they are another class of drugs that are almost in the class of atypical antipsychotics or SSRIs. They almost shouldn't be used. You know, arguably, they shouldn't have ever been invented. I mean, it's outrageous. The expense to benefit ratio is almost infinite.
So you agree with me now and not Kramer all these years later.
Yeah, yeah. No, Kramer is an apologist. I'm sure he was paid, you know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The thing was very well written, better written than your book.
Well, mine was a scientific book.
I know.
But I grant you it was written much more like a novel.
So what is, I mean, I could dive into, I've got almost a prepared presentation. I could dive into any individual medical specialty if you're interested in any single one, or we can continue to talk about my,
I want to have a nice conversation with you.
Okay.
Just keep talking about things that might be interesting, and I'll pull on a thread if I think it's interesting. Well, I'm still not clear. What got you to turn around at that age? I mean, in your 60s, for goodness sakes. That's right. Not even that long ago. You're only, what, 67 now?
67.
So how long have you been enlightened?
5 years.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
I started 5 years ago.
Was it terrifying?
No. It was...
it was terrifying when I was 35 and looking at all this.
Yeah. Well, I mean... The amazing thing is once I figured it out, how few people had any freaking clue about it. I mean, it's just the wool is pulled over everyone's eyes, and the physicians, they are consumed by their work. It's very hard work. It's time consumptive. It's emotionally difficult. They don't have time for even their finances or their families. And to expect them to try to uncover or examine the roots of the of where their knowledge came from is too much to ask of them. And I understand where they're coming from. A few of them know what I'm talking about, but the main people who know are journalists who've tried to examine it. You know,
no, there aren't very many of those. I mean,
no, not very many. Martha knows the whole story. Martha Rosenberg.
Yeah,
you know her pretty well. So you know much about oncology.
Not a lot. I think we should talk about that. I mean, anything you talk about is going to be new and interesting to most people.
Well, I'd sort of like to set the foundation of this thing a little bit better. It'll just take me about 3 minutes. You know, healthcare costs are $4 trillion, and they're about 20% of our GDP. Other countries, they're about 10%. And in Singapore, they get away with 5%. But their results are better than ours. We're like 40th or something like that on the mortality scale. Our half of our care is ineffective or actually harmful. And I'll just quote some references off the top. There's a Scientific American article about that, British Medical Journal Clinical Evidence Survey. Vinay Prasad talked about that in an article. Robert Woods Johnson Foundation has that finding. Institute of Medicine, the Congressional Budget Office, estimates that 30% of medical care is unnecessary. There's a Milman Health Waste Calculator that says useless therapeutic activities are 48%. And, you know, Ioannidis, of course, the smartest guy in the room, he agrees. So half of our medicine is wrong, and that's academically incontrovertible. And I don't know how this could have happened in a field led by doctors. I didn't understand it. I respected doctors. They were my
friends. It's not led by doctors.
I know. Absolutely. But how could doctors have been influenced so heavily? And I read about influence theory, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Cialdini's influence theory. He's a popularizer. He's a Phoenix psychologist who's famous for this. And his book, Influence, is an industry Bible to teach salesmen how to get people to do whatever they want. And the main principle is, if you give someone a gift, it's overwhelmingly powerful. And so doctors are gifted, they're paid, they're this and that. You wouldn't think it'd make any difference. You'd think a conflict of interest disclaimer would sanitize them, like industry says, but it doesn't. Anytime money changes hands, the influence is absolute. And small gifts make big influences. So where should I go next? I mean, I've got more about the deceptive math in the journals. The back surgery is a mess.
Do you have looking at this degree of corruption, which is, you know, stunning to behold. As I looked into COVID-19, I realized, you know, that the whole thing is a corruption. It's a cover story for a combination of making billions of dollars on vaccines, taking control of governments around the world, and getting rid of America as a patriotic nation that's going to resist globalism. So I see this huge, huge corruption. And I think that this is a part of it, an example of it. It's as if whenever human beings get into large groups of any kind, power rises to the top. Corruption, the most shrewd, nasty, mean, not necessarily smartest, but the most likely to be a sociopath, rises to the top, kind of a phenomena. Is this the sense you have of what's going on? And
okay, I really have no clue about what's going on internationally. I mean, I read all the stories. I was unhappy with the politics last year, but I know about medicine, and I was not surprised. This is not new behavior for pharma. They are a bit more entitled, and they are a bit more open about what they're doing right now.
Right. But that's important. This is not new.
Not new behavior.
That's very important.
It's 21st century behavior. The last 20 years is when they started to pretty much control all their trials, ghostwrite all their papers, do all this.
It's older than that. They were doing it when 1994, when I was the scientist for all the combined Prozac trials against Eli Lilly.
It's
getting worse
since the last 20 years. It's just they are willing to do or say almost anything. And so I don't have a clue about the international organization or what's going on. And
okay.
It certainly doesn't look good. But I really can't comment besides that. I'm very disappointed by the whole totality of medicine. I mean, I see the problems going into the clinic with my wife. And I mean, it's just miserable. I mean, patients need physician level knowledge to get decent care now. That's the story. And I can get good care for my wife because I'm a physician, but the other guys can't. They're at the mercy of the system, and they're at the mercy of the bills and everything else. I mean, I know what's going on because I studied it for 4 years.
Yeah, the average physician's at the mercy of all this stuff.
Yeah. He
has no idea what's going on when he gives out the, he feels like he'll be doing wrong if he doesn't give out a lipid pill.
That's right. Those, the standards are essentially bought off. Pharma buys the KOLs, you know, the key opinion leaders. They have an acronym for these people they're bribing. They buy these people because their ability to give gifts to ordinary providers has been truncated by the law, right? So they give these research grants and unlimited funding to these key opinion leaders, and these guys create the practice standards, and these are enforced by the HMOs and the insurance companies and everyone else who think that's the way to practice medicine because, you know, it's all dictated by an academic physician who's been bought. So that's the way it's going.
Yeah, you mentioned some things in that regard that were in your book. Again, it's butchered by healthcare. You talked about how some journals would guarantee publication to a pharmaceutical company if they bought a certain number of reprints to fatten the pot for the journal.
That was a quote by someone that paid the money and later got out of it. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. The reprints are a kickback from the pharma company to the journal in exchange for publication. And the reprint income, well, these journals have incredible reprint income. Probably the lowest is the BMJ, British Medical Journal, which has probably the best remaining integrity left.
That's good. I'm good to hear that. I think there's some evidence for that. And you've met Jeannie Lenzer. You thank her in your book.
Yeah, I think I met Jeannie. I do.
Yeah, she's written articles for them. I don't know how often she's doing it now.
Yeah.
But yes, I think that the others are just awful.
Yeah, they're awful. They're spending more time on critical race theory than science now. I mean, it's really crazy.
I'd like to hear more about the journals if you want to talk more about the way they're influenced. I mean, the journals, you know, we're supposed to have.
Okay, so they have
this peer review.
Yeah,
you know,
they have startling. Okay. So one way to look at the healthcare industry is their profit margins. Do you know what Pfizer's profit margin was the last 5 years? It's an amazing figure. It means they are in bed with the government money spigots. 50%. I know it's shocking. It's shocking.
Oh, explain that. You got to explain that one too.
Well, I don't. You can look it up. Google it. Okay, I'm going to tell you more about the other.
Well, explain what a profit margin is. We don't ever get things really direct here.
Profit margin is, I believe, it's the amount of money they have to declare in taxes, or there may be, you know, there's two different kinds. There's gross profit and there's net profit, but it's a big number, and your number is not supposed to be above 10%. A very successful industry.
Yeah.
Has a profit margin of 10%. The used car, the car rental industry probably has a 4% profit margin. They make bank, you know. But these pharma companies, along with a few other industries like banking, have profit margins around 25%, right? So this is a badge of government involvement. It means that they're getting money from a tap line somewhere, you know. So, I mean, it's
gonna be interesting because. Of course, they've gotten a lot of money under COVID-19 from the federal government and a lot of other kinds of perks as well and help. Maybe they'll exceed 50% this year.
Who knows?
For 2020.
Elsevier, the biggest publishing house, has a profit margin of 37% several years. I mean, it was 37 and 36. They have the journals have few expenses. Their articles are mainly submitted by pharma or volunteer people. Their editors are volunteer. They get They get the money from the reprints. I mean, it's a remarkable business model.
Well, the advertising is probably the biggest mainstays of all. Yeah.
Have you ever tried to buy a journal article?
Well, I go through that all the time, but I don't buy them. It's a pain in the neck.
Do you know about Sci-Hub?
I haven't been using that stuff. But you know, the interesting thing about COVID-19 is that the companies are pretty much make all that available now. That's an interesting phenomenon. So I haven't been running into it so much. In the COVID-19 area, most of the relevant information is readily available. But occasionally I run into it. But explain what you were going to explain.
Okay, Sci-Hub is a hacker site based in Russia that's illegally, it's illegal.
Describe it. Give the name of it.
SCI-HUB. And I'm not recommending that you use it, because if I did, I'd be recommending you break the law. But academics publicly thank them. And if you drop the URL, the address of the article you want that's behind the paywall, into the Sci-Hub main front page of their website, in most cases, if it's a New England Journal of Medicine or a major journal, they'll bring up the whole journal article for you for free. So anyway, I'm not recommending anything, but that's an easy way to access journals. And the Wayback Machine is another great thing to get a hold of.
Yeah.
To get a hold of dead links that somebody's concealed or covered up. If you still have the URL, you just put that in the Wayback Machine and you can get multiple copies of it. Nothing ever vanishes from the web. Not even the Chinese, who try to rewrite history, can destroy the Wayback Machine.
And tell people again exactly how to use that.
Google Wayback Machine, enter the URL or the address of the article that's disappeared that you get the bad link for, right? You have to know the URL. You have to preserve the address. Yeah. And you enter that into...
That's the original address that's been erased. You have to preserve that and put it in.
Well, and sometimes you can find a link in an article and you find that is a bad link, right? Yeah. So you just take the bad link off the top of your browser and paste that into the Wayback Machine Internet Archive, Google Wayback Machine Internet Archive. And there's others too, but that one's the one everybody uses. And it's preserved indefinitely. And there are some things that I'm sure were concealed for commercial reasons that I referenced on the Wayback Machine in my book.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there were some things, there've been a lot of things scrubbed by the Chinese recently.
You can find any of that. Yeah.
But a lot of it is obtainable. We've gotten, I think, just about everything we've really looked for using these various techniques.
Yeah. Well, I can speak about a few medical issues that are, it's crazy. I can't believe they're still doing them like this.
Go ahead.
So oncology is one of the most blatantly, I mean, it's a real problem specialty, because I don't know, most people aren't aware that 65 or 70% of their income comes from retailing chemotherapy drugs at 20%, right? That's the standard cut. Now, were that drug sold to them by a physician, that would be called capping, and the person would go to jail for a federal crime if he was caught. But if it's sold by a pharmaceutical company to the doctor, there's some sort of exception, and they're allowed to retail these things. So that is one of the worst conflicts of interest in medicine. It gets worse. They are rewarded by the milligram sales. So they are encouraged to use larger doses despite any patient toxicity. Now, if you think the doctors are ethical, and I think doctors are ethical, and I think they try their best, but you understand influence theory, you understand that money trumps every possible good will that a doctor has. And if you're making $1 million a year from retailing chemotherapy drugs, you're going to sell the most important thing almost regardless of toxicity or efficacy. Now that's a sad story, and I know it sounds improbable, but if you understand influence theory, you understand the trends are going to be in that direction. So that's the horrible problem with oncology.
I mean, you know, this folks, this really is true, and it's kind of hard to deal with. But the entire profession of psychiatry was turned away from psychotherapy probably in less than a generation, simply by the fact that other people could do it more cheaply, like social workers, and they could make a lot more money doing drugs. So literally places like Johns Hopkins stopped teaching psychotherapy, stopped teaching psychiatrists to talk to people, literally.
You know,
because the money flowed in that in the other direction.
I appreciate your humanistic ideas and your ideas of human contact with your patient, and it makes perfect sense. And the drugs, almost without exception, are heavily addictive, and they create some behavior patterns that are terrible. And it basically gets people on these things, and it's increased our social security roles and everything else. They're chronics,
yep.
You know, and you know this, and I know I'm speaking to the choir, and I hate to reiterate this before your audience.
Please.
Yeah.
You're not going to, a lot of the audience is here for
naive for. Okay.
For other reasons, especially nowadays, right. Because most of my guests are not talking about psychiatry. So have a good time. Go ahead.
Okay. Well,
nor medicine in general. They don't hear a lot of medicine in general.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind saying a few words about prostate cancer. And I always quote Eric Hoffer, every great cause begins with a movement, becomes a business, and eventually degenerates into a racket. So urology's approach to this disease has undergone a kind of an outing. Radical prostatectomy is a horrible surgery that is disfiguring and causes a lot of problems. And the net result of running the mathematics are it causes more harm than good. The other treatments include testosterone blockers. You know, you're familiar with Lupron. And Lupron has, it decreases prostate cancer deaths by one third, right? So that sounds like a good thing. That's called a relative risk of prostate cancer death. However, the overall risk for the patients goes up. You get it? Because Lupron destroys testosterone, and testosterone protects your heart and has a lot of other positive effects. So the overall mortality in people who are treated with Lupron probably escalates, even though their chances of dying from prostate cancer go down in all the studies. So their relative risk goes down, and all these studies are reported in terms of that. So and the stories about that are just terrible. I mean, they just... So we have these screening tests, right? You're familiar with mammographies and colonoscopies. The numbers don't work on those. In other words, they cause more, they cause a cascade of medical care that's more dangerous than the original problem, and they have small risks, right? And so, and they're very
small benefits, you mean?
The benefits are very small. But colonoscopies, for example, there's a 1 in 10,000 of them gets poked or, you know, punctured, or maybe it's 1 in several thousand, and then 10% of those die. So it's a small risk, but it's more than the good for a screening colonoscopy. Of course, if you have blood coming out of your backside, you need a colonoscopy. Of course, if you have abdominal pain and you want to work it up, you need a colonoscopy. And in other countries, this is the standard, but in America, we've let our gastroenterologists run wild and insist that we get colonoscopized every few years. This doesn't improve overall mortality.
But it makes money for the,
makes enormous
the
amount
GI
of money.
Guys, yeah. Because they behave like surgeons. They do the colonoscopies.
Yep. Yeah. The mammogram's a politically correct feminist issue, right? But it's the same way. The way you can think about mammography and breast cancer is that the number of cases diagnosed went way up, but the fatalities are absolutely flat. And that's true for a lot of different cancers. And I can bring that up on my screen if you want and show you those curves if you'd like.
You give it a try. I don't think we've ever succeeded at that
I can do it. Hang on one second here. It'd take a second. Let me see if... Do you have other questions or other, I can tell you a little bit about CPR, right?
Medical
Okay. The emergency physicians all know CPR doesn't work at all. I know that sounds flat-footed, and maybe it does help if you've had an MI and you're having arrhythmia, right? It does help if you're an opioid overdose, perhaps to get a few breaths of air while your Narcan rescues you. But if you examine the manuals for CPR, they tell you that drug treatment does not work for CPR. And in fact, rescue breathing has never been shown to work despite tens, if not hundreds of thousands of patients studied. So CPR is just a bad joke. The emergency physicians all know it. The American Heart Association has a budget of something like $600 or $700 million a year, two-thirds to three-quarters of $1 billion a year that they must get from industry, right? You can't get that kind of an industry from donations or charges or anything else. They make $130 million a year teaching CPR, right? So they promulgate all this stuff, and it's completely ineffective. And they come up with new standards that everybody has to memorize, and you have to be CPR and ACLS certified and all this crazy stuff. And so that's about
it. It's new to me. Thank you. Very new to me. Oh, my gosh.
Do you want to hear
about it?
Okay. Do you want to hear about, you know, the second worst insurance system is called workman's compensation. I'm going to tell you the worst in a moment. You can think about that while I'm telling you about work comp. But work comp is a small potatoes compared to the $4 trillion in healthcare, right? It's in 2017, it was $97 billion. It's probably over $100 billion now. After the insurance companies took their cut, you know, their ordinary cut in healthcare is 20-25%, maybe more for the Blue Cross or something like that. But after that, there was only 64% left. So the insurance companies took an unusual amount of that. But that wasn't the worst. That's not the worst of work comp. The fraud estimates are a quarter to one half, right? The litigation is at least 10%. That's very conservative. The provider overhead is another 10%. This thing may have, very conservatively, it's got a 75% overhead before a dime goes to the patients. It has poor outcomes due to these terrible incentives and financial gains. People stay off work too long. They get all this, you know, it's a lot of nonsense. But you know what the worst medical delivery system of all is? It's called personal injury lawsuits. They're worse. The reason why they're worse is it's all about the money. It's 100% money. The standard rule of thumb is a third of the money in a settlement goes to the physician, a third goes to the patient, and a third goes to the lawyer, right? So you're left with a third for the patient right off the bat before any other expenses are factored in. The fraud for that is thought to be almost universal, and there are people who, immigrants who are told to go out in the middle of an intersection and get hit by trucks inside an old beater car, and they're paid off. So, I mean, it's a wild scene. Overprescribing. You know what the average, in LA, I've got a figure for the average number of drugs the nursing home patients take. Guess high. 20. Now that sounds high to me. I thought it was 10. I knew about it.
I'm looking at a blank at you because I kind of lost track of what you were saying there. And part of thinking about some of these other things you've said, but do that one again for me, at least on the nursing homes.
So the average nursing home patient, perhaps, you know, I don't have a public.
Oh, how many drugs they're on.
Yeah, how many drugs they're on. Okay, so these things are force-fed to demented patients as a group, as a rule, right?
Yeah.
We never studied drugs. We only study drugs in isolation because were we to study combinations of drugs, it would be phenomenally expensive. So we study individual drugs. So nobody knows about drug interactions. There's basically nothing published about it at all. So these things
are very little. It's amazing. And in psychiatry, people may get on 10 psych drugs and the evidence for any one of them isn't very good, and you put them all together, making people very sick.
It's horrendous. Well, my wife had a comment about those nursing home drugs, and she said, fortunately, in America, 90% of the drugs are generics, right? Because we can't afford the pharma companies have gouged us so much that the proprietary drugs, the patented drugs, the drugs that are, we know the manufacturing quality is good, those things are so expensive, nobody can afford them but an insurance company writing blank checks. That's the only, okay. So she said that it's fortunate for the nursing home patients because the generic drugs are so bad that they don't get at very big doses. And they otherwise we'd kill every one of them, you know. So I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly there's some truth to it, because generic drugs are a very mixed bag. Generic drugs, some of them are stronger, some of them are weaker. The quality control is less impressive. I mean, we've all seen that clinically. Anyone who's worked in clinical medicine has seen problems with, you know, the generic Norvasc or other, you know, I mean, I've seen that. People don't like it. The longer acting metoprolol doesn't last as long as the good proprietary drug. So the trouble with the patent drugs is not that they're not well made. They have enough money, they can make them very well. But the problem is they're too expensive for anyone to afford.
Can we go back to CPR? Do you know more about that, or have you kind of told us everything you know?
I've got another.
Because that's fascinating to me. Yeah. I always assumed, of course, that was helpful.
No, it doesn't work at all. Here's how you can prove this to yourself. The best reference is not to plow through the CPR literature, but to get behind one of these paywalls and look at the manuals that they use to teach physicians how to do CPR. And the guys that are writing those things are academic emergency physicians, and they admit inside the manuals that that there's no evidence for it. And that's the way they put it. But the real bottom line is not that there's no evidence for it. There's a great deal of evidence that nothing they've ever done has been efficacious, including rescue breathing, except for in narrow cases. You know what I mean? In other words, look, if you have somebody in the field who's not breathing, you know, you're going to try. But the chances of, I can tell you a couple more colorful details, right? The people that study this, they like to write survival to hospital discharge as one of their endpoints, right? Well, now, who would care whether they survived a hospital discharge? You know, I mean, the real bottom line is that they make it longer term. You know, does to survive to hospital discharge is a gore, right? Or as somebody that's brain damaged, the chances of a successful CPR in an elderly person are almost zero. Now, on the street in Japan, they did this study where they did, you know, shock and a little bit of pushing and this and that and breathing. And they had a 3% survival rate, 3%. Now that's the best anyone's ever done for CPR.
So we're including in that now, putting the boards clapping on the chest and giving a shock to get an arrhythmia turned around.
Yeah, post heart attack, immediately post heart attack, emergency physicians have all seen people turned around by living better electrically, right, by shocking them. And of course, every cardiologist saves people routinely during their time in the cath lab when they're doing angioplasties they shouldn't do. You know, they irritate the heart, they get go into arrhythmias, and then the shocking is used routinely to tune up adverse heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation and ventricular fibrillation, and, you know, they use them for all kinds of things. But in the setting of a spontaneous arrest, the chances of any of this being efficacious are almost zero. And in fact, my whole generation, and I'm a board-certified emergency physician, or at least I was. I passed the boards three times and finally let it lapse. But my whole generation, we all swore that we would have tattooed on our chest, "Do not resuscitate," right? Because it was such an outrageous, aggressive, violent abuse of somebody trying to do a natural process like kick the bucket. So it doesn't work, you know? I mean, and anyone who has an arrest, a physician who's working on arrest of a patient, if they don't go through the tracking of whatever the American Heart Association has come up with last, they'll be sued, and the claim will be that my uncle would have survived had he gotten, you know, one of these anti-arrhythmic drugs. I mean, a lot of the things have been proven to be quite harmful, you know, and aggressively harmful to survival. But the real bottom line is none of it works. I mean, you know, they've got studies that show rescue breathing doesn't work, which is very surprising. Obviously, if you have an opioid overdose, the problem is just breathing. So you can breathe for them and they'll be fine for a while. You breathe for them for a short time or until you get the Narcan or whatever. So there are exceptions to what I'm saying, but I tend to make declarative statements so listeners who are unfamiliar with this material will understand. But my references are in the manuscript, in the ebook of Butchered by Healthcare. I got 500 or 800 references. So you can go through those and get a sprinkling of the science. I can talk about gynecologists for a moment. You know what percent of women before they're 60 have a hysterectomy? Guess high, 30%. Okay, so this is regarded as one of the most overperformed surgeries of all. And the women get sold on having an additional overectomy, you know, oophorectomy, by the following. And this happened to myself and my wife. They said, well, you won't have to worry about ovarian cancer if you get those ovaries out, right? Do you see the flaw in that reasoning? Okay, he's talking about the relative risk of dying of ovarian cancer, which is very low. Ovarian cancer is one of the most rare cancers of all, right? And he says you can eliminate that, but what do you get when you take your ovaries out? You've thrown into a horrible premature menopause, and even if you get your ovaries out when you're 55, they're still putting out hormones, and those protect your heart and other body systems from aging processes that would kill you. So overall, getting your ovaries out is a huge mistake. And when you get your hysterectomy, now some hysterectomies are necessary. They have fibroids or ovarian or uterine cancer or something like that. But a third of the women up until 60 have their uteruses out. Now, to bang on the gynecologist some more, do you know what the statistic is for C-section percent of live births in America? It's the highest in the world. It's a third, same figure. So this does not improve mortality, right? The sweet spot in mortality is roughly 15%. This is done for convenience, for financial gains. I mean, who knows what it's done for, but it subjects women to a surgical procedure with 10 times the mortality, albeit it's very low, but 10 times the mortality of a natural delivery. Natural delivery, roughly 1 in 10,000 fatality. Right? C-section, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000, 1 in 3,000 mortality, right? So it's much more dangerous to get a C-section, but it's very, very convenient and much better paying for the gynecologist.
Well, the gynecologist can determine when he'll be away from home and exactly. When he'll be in the hospital a lot better.
To get back onto oncology,
do you know the difference between what a gynecologist gets for a birth versus a live birth versus a C-section?
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with the figures.
I'll bet it's big.
I don't know what it is, but it's definitely more. So I know a lot about dermatology. I did a year of dermatology. I don't know whether you're interested in that. It's almost seems like a minor problem compared to the stuff we mentioned.
I think that the skin's a very important organ.
Okay, so in the 60s or the 70s, the dermatologists were sort of losing their way, and they hired a Madison Avenue public relations firm to ask what they should do to make their specialty more important. And so that firm advised the dermatologists to change themselves from foolish pimple poppers into aggressive cancer fighters, right? So what they did is they started publicizing melanoma, and they changed their definitions of skin cancer to include an entity called actinic keratosis.
Yes.
Which they call a pre-squamous cell cancer. But in fact, actinic keratosis, half of them will involute within a year or two or go away, and the rest of them can be treated practically with your fingernail. Now, I'm exaggerating, but they're something that they don't need aggressive treatment. They don't need surgical treatment. They certainly, those little blow torches the dermatologists use on them, on hundreds of them at once, those work fine. So they started making people afraid of skin cancer. The melanoma story was even worse. Their incidence of melanoma went way up, right? And the incidence reflects identification of early lesions, but their mortality is rock stable. Right. So we did absolutely nothing for melanomas by scaring the hell out of the entire populace and having them huddle inside with a sun hat over their head and applying all these sunscreens so our vitamin D levels crash. We have not done anyone a service with all those derm things. The other in concert with this,
Dr. Yoho, we are getting near the end.
No worries.
And I don't know how the heck to draw all this together. It's a very distressing, disturbing situation we're in with this modern medicine and its industrialization and these giant corporations, as well as you're emphasizing now something I've not thought a lot about, which is how the individual specialties bloat themselves as well.
Everybody's snatching at the pie. I'm going to end with a quote from Otis Brawley, who was the chief of the American Cancer Society until 2018. He said, the system is not failing. It's functioning exactly as designed. It's designed to run up healthcare costs, and it's about the greedy serving the gluttonous.
Do you have any thoughts about what a better direction would be? I mean, I struggle with this because big government doesn't seem to be an answer. Government oversight and government monitoring, FDA, CDC, they're all corrupt. Maybe a skeptic, we get back to good old skeptical consumer.
Okay, so I thought a lot about this. I've got a whole section of my book about it.
You got two minutes.
All right. The Kaiser model. Now, Kaiser's not perfect, but they integrate the insurance, the doctors, and the hospitals in one entity. And in theory, they all pull with one harness, and they do a little better. So you can read about that in my book. I have a lot of other suggestions, basically, we're getting cannibalized, so we don't have any choice but to act. I mean, on a personal level, knowing the limits of medical care and understanding that you can't be saved from every freaking problem that you have by a doctor is very important. So I don't think the single payer is a solution. The federal government has shown it to be incompetent to manage Medicare, the Veterans Administration, and the Indian Health Organization. It's all three are a mess. Anyone that's ever worked in the latter two can certainly ratify what I say. Medicare is a fiscal disaster. And
I guess the national health programs probably cut costs more because the government is probably making some cost cutting. Is that true or false?
Not in America.
I mean, like in Great Britain or Canada.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you can talk to people over there for their expertise about that. But in America, we have this blend of capitalism and, you know, the insurance companies and all the whole thing. And I don't think it's easy to cut costs. I mean, we're literally spending double what we should. And it's, yeah.
Well, let's end on that. Connecting it to a lot of the work I've been doing lately in Ginger and, you know, with our book. I guess I haven't even mentioned our book. Folks, Ginger and I have a new book coming out soon, COVID-19 and the Global Predators. And it'll be out in late May, but it's probably going to be July, early July. But if you purchase the book, you immediately get the latest manuscript because we want the information out about what's going on. So if you go to our dedicated website just for the book, wearethepray.com. wearethepray.com, and you purchase the book at quite a reasonable cost, you get the manuscript. But what continues to strike me is that you have to really look on a micro level to see anything resembling capitalism in the world today.
That's right.
Is free market. Maybe mom and pop, maybe an occasional good doc, an occasional good professional person. They're running their businesses in a free market fashion. But once they get big, they're all predatory capitalists. They barely differ from predatory progressives like the communists. And right now, what my book concludes is on a world level, it's the predatory capitalists are actually working with the communists, Chinese. So it's a bizarre situation. Well, thank you for being on. It's been a whirlwind of be cautious. A whirlwind of be a really educated consumer. And it's been a pleasure to get to know you and to listen to just this amazing amount of stuff you've been looking at.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan. My website is Robert Yoho Author, RobertYohoAuthor.com.
Thank you. And thank you, my wonderful audience. And as always, thank you for taking seriously these sometimes really difficult and dismaying facts of life. Maybe I should call the show Sometimes Dismaying Facts of Life. Thank you.